House Elections Committee will come to order. Welcome, members. We don't have a quorum yet, but even in the absence of a quorum, I think we should proceed with the first bill. We obviously can't move the minutes yet either. Representative Bernardi, do you care to chair? I see. Representative Halverson's here. I'm sorry, our vice chair is here. I didn't even see her here. Go ahead.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know we can't take action to move your bill, but we are certainly ready to hear your presentation and any testimony on it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. House File 367 is a bill that we debated at length last year, but per House rule, it was kicked back to this committee as its last committee of origin. It made it all the way to the General Register, and that's why it's here. So I really want to treat this more as a procedural vote. This is the ranked choice voting local option bill. I don't think it's new to anyone. It simply says that municipalities may, not shall, may experiment with ranked choice voting as long as they adhere to certain standards. We had a ton of testimony, a great debate last year. It's not my intention to revisit that, much less repeat it. And so I think folks know where they are, but I would appreciate your support in just putting it back where it was, which is the General Register. That's really it. I have no testifiers. But I would appreciate the courtesy of at least putting it back to where it was originally. We don't have a quorum, but I just wanted to get this out of the way now.
We have a quorum now.
Okay.
So we can, if you'd like to move your bill, we could.
Yeah, I just moved that House File 367 be re-referred to the General Register.
Very good. Are there any questions for Representative Simon on the bill before us? Seeing none, I think that we are prepared to vote. I'm stalling just a bit. Oh, Representative Johnson.
A couple things. Did you read the information?
Representative Johnson, you might want to use your microphone. I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
I request a roll call on this vote.
Okay, a roll call has been requested.
Looking at it, Mr.
Representative Johnson.
Looking at some of the information, I do have a little bit of a problem with ranked choice voting. Some of the statistics are showing it disenfranchises minorities more than some of the others. I think this needs to be looked at a lot closer. Looking at the, and that, I don't think it's needed. Looking at the numbers of the last ranked choice voting for the mayor of Minneapolis, if you actually start calculating the numbers, the percentage of difference between the first and second place after the first round was almost identical to the 32nd round, where we could have had that information right at the beginning, as soon as the votes were tabulated, who the winner was, instead of waiting till, I can't remember, was the next day or a few days before you actually found out who the newly elected mayor is in Minnesota. Personally, I don't believe this is going to be any helpful in the election process and just make it more cumbersome.
Representative Simon?
Well, I appreciate that perspective. Representative Johnson, obviously I disagree with you on the merits. I'm not so sure if we need to rebut charge that this has a disparate impact on communities of color. In fact, there are people here in the legislature who have changed their minds the other way on that after the Minneapolis experience. All I would say about the bill, rather than getting into the merits, is this is a local option bill. Right now, under current law, only a select set of cities has the right to do this without legislative approval. Otherwise, if you're Roseville, if you're Red Wing, if you're any number of communities that are thinking of experimenting with this, they have to sort of come on bended knee to the legislature and ask for permission. So all that this bill does is enable them, if they choose, or if their voters or their city councils choose, however they have set it up, to do this. And it might not be right for my community, might not be right for your community, but if Roseville wants to experiment with this, as they've expressed an interest in doing, or other communities around the state, they can do it. And it's now not so new. We have Minneapolis and St. Paul who have done it each for a couple of elections, and so there is at least there are some guiding principles not only in the bill but in practice. So that's really what it's all about, and I understand the arguments about why it might be a bad idea for a particular community, but I just think we ought to let them make that choice, that's all. And again, members, for those of you who just came in, we had a full debate on this last year. It made it to the General Register. I would just like to have it reprocessed back to the General Register.
Any other questions for the author of the bill? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, I noticed that your handouts are from your former campaign manager and a campaign consultant of mine and somebody that I went to high school with, Anthony Newby. I also know that I have at least one constituent in the audience who supports ranked choice voting. And so I think I'll let you send this bill to the floor and vote to do that, although it's not without an extreme amount of reluctance that I do that. My hope is that the General Register is one of the places this year where bills go to die. because I'm not convinced of the experience we've seen with ranked choice voting, but you know, I'm happy to. I'd hate to see the chair's bill not make it out of committee.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. And Representative Winkler, thank you for that. I know it's with extreme reluctance that you would vote to send this back, but think of how much fun we'd have if this actually came up for. This is one of those rare instances where you and I disagree, and it could be a fun floor debate. So you'd be robbing yourself of a genuinely enjoyable experience if this were to just wither on the vine in committee. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Simon,
Representative Winkler,
you're evoking memories of National Popular Vote last session, which does prove that one legislator can make a difference.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
thank you. I'm still smarting from that experience, and notwithstanding that, I would appreciate your support.
Well, and Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and members, I remember the hearing we had on this bill last year, and there were at least two bills in that committee, one from Winkler and one from Simon, and the two reps from the same community voted against each other. And there's nothing I love more than a fight in the family.
And to that point, Representative Huntley, I see that I believe have some students that joined us here from St. Paul Prep. Is that correct? So for the students, you can see that everything at the legislature is always very buttoned up and very serious. and this is a great example that not everybody and every party agrees on everything. So disagreements are good, and they happen, and it makes life pretty exciting around here. So we love the St. Louis Park turf battle that goes on in our
committee. And Madam Chair, and as you know,
Representative
Winkler and I disagree so seldom that when it happens, we almost cultivate and celebrate it because it's an occasion for fun. So
absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you. Is any other comments from committee members? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to be heard on this bill before us? Please come down to the table. Welcome to the committee, and if you can state your name, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, the committee members, my name is Liana Gale, and I'm a Green Party member. And I would just encourage you to work on ranked choice voting, not just at the municipal level, but also on the state level. We have concerns about the spoiler effect. And for us as a party, it is, for example, very important just to gain party status that we receive a specific amount of votes, 1% to become a minor party and 5% at the major party at the state level. And procedures at ranked choice voting will give us a chance for people to really vote their conscience and not consider us as a spoiler in elections. So ranked choice voting is a step towards a more democratic system. And therefore, I would support passing of House File 377, and also I would encourage you strongly to make headways to have ranked choice voting at the state level also, to kind of bring more democracy to the two-party system. And I think it will be beneficial not just to the general public, but also to the two parties. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. And would you be so kind as to spell your name so we have it correct in the record?
Okay, my name is Liane Gale, L-I-A-N-E, and then Gale, G-A-L-E.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If there's no one else who wishes to be heard on this, doesn't appear to be, any final comments from the author of the bill?
No, I just ask for your support, members, in putting it back where it was at the end of last session, notwithstanding people's principled objections. We can have that fight, if we have it at all, on the floor.
Very good. There has been a roll call requested, so Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 367 be re-referred to the General Register, and the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Halverson?
Aye.
Representative Sanders? Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Dowd? Representative Huntley?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Lane?
Aye.
Representative Mariani?
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Representative Erdahl? Drum roll, please. Representative Winkler?
I guess.
Would you like to clarify that for the record, Representative
yes.
Winkler?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
There being seven ayes and two nays, the motion prevails, and the bill goes to the General Register.
Thank you, members. Okay, members will now hear House File 19. Oh, you know, as Representative Winkler is going up for his bill, why don't we entertain motions on the minutes? We have two sets of minutes to process and approve. The first is a reapproval of the minutes of Tuesday, March 4th. Representative Bernardi moves that we reapprove the minutes of March 4th. I say reapprove because there was a mistake, just inadvertently there was an error in there about an amendment that was mentioned, that was passed out to committee but was never actually offered, but it was mentioned by mistake in the minutes. And so that's why we have to reapprove them. So Representative Bernardi moves that we reapprove the minutes of Tuesday, March 4th, 2014. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Next, we'll entertain Representative Bernardi's motion to approve the minutes of Thursday, March 6th, 2014. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Now to your bill, Representative Winkler, House File 1944.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 1944 be re-referred to the General Register. And Mr. Chair, I have an A1 amendment, which I think will make that more straightforward.
Okay.
I'd like to offer the A1.
Representative Winkler offers the A1 amendment. To the amendment.
And to the amendment, page 8, lines 21 through 36 are civil penalties. I think the board has adequate enforcement mechanisms at its disposal today that would not require it to add these additional civil penalties, so I'm deleting them from the bill. And I believe, let me just double check. I don't remember the purpose for the deletion on page 11, line 18. Oh, I see. That's just the effective date. Got it. Yep, so it only does two things. It removes the civil penalties and it adds the effective date. That's what I thought. And the reason to add an effective date is to make sure that this applies to the primary and general election of 2014.
Okay. To the amendment, any other testifiers on the amendment? Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the A1 amendment? Members, any questions, concerns just about the A1 amendment? Okay, seeing none. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. To the bill as amended, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill essentially deals with two issues for campaign disclosure. The first is the definition of express advocacy in statute, and that is basically to add additional language to statute to include so that when you are running an ad that is advocating for the election of a candidate, we have a kind of catch-all provision that simply says that if there's no other way to interpret the language but to advocate for a candidate, that is considered express advocacy and subject to campaign disclosure. And if we don't have that, basically people, organizations can run an ad, use some magic, as long as they don't use a few points of, you know, a few magic words, they can avoid the disclosure requirement. So this is just to essentially kind of close down a loophole that would allow people to easily circumvent the disclosure requirements. Section 4 deals with electioneering communications, and those are that kind of communication that talks about perhaps a legislator and an issue, and it encourages you to call them to thank them for their vote on something. And in general, that would be not subject to disclosure in campaigns unless, under this bill, that advocacy is conducted 30 days before a primary election or 60 days before a general election or a special election, on the basic theory that there is really no reason to run an ad in, associating with a candidate with any particular issue or position on an issue unless that was for the purpose of influencing the election. And if it is for the purpose of influencing the election, the source of the funds that paid for that ad should be subject to public disclosure because it is an attempt to influence the election. So this bill contains provisions that were deleted from the omnibus campaign finance reform. It's a bill last year, maybe not technically an omnibus, but the one that we passed. It closes some key loopholes that allow organizations and special interests to funnel money through particular ways of advocating, particular ways of speaking that seem to circumvent the requirements that we have in law now. And I think if we want to have disclosure of funds based on the new world we live in now after Citizens United, where there is essentially no restriction on independent expenditures by corporations or unions or anybody else, without those restrictions, we need disclosure. The U.S. Supreme Court explicitly referenced that in its majority opinion in Citizens United. And so if we don't have full disclosure of where the money comes from and we have unlimited spending, we are in a very bad situation, which is why I think it's essential that we pass this legislation this year. And the members have specific questions on the details of the bill or how exactly it will work. Gary Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board is here. And I should specify that while the Campaign Finance Board in general supports these provisions, they have a separate version of the bill that is a little bit different. So I'm not here to say that this is the Campaign Finance Board's bill, but it is similar in concept and has many provisions that are the same. And Mr. Goldsmith can address any provisions that are contained in this bill.
Okay, I think what we'll do, Representative Winkler, is we'll take testimony from those who have signed up to testify, and then, of course, others from the public, and then we'll go to the amendments after that. Mr. Goldsmith, since you're already here, we'll defer to you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As Representative Winkler says, this bill fills two loopholes that have been recognized by organizations that want to spend money to influence Minnesota elections without any accountability for either their spending or the sources of money that they use for that spending. I have examples of the two types of communication. I'm not going to pass them out, but one is a communication was mailed out in a House race in 2012. It was designed specifically to look exactly like express advocacy, but to avoid the words vote for and vote against. And the communicator in this case actually clarified with the campaign finance board that this communication would fit within the loophole so that he wouldn't have to register a report about this communication. It's directed to homeowners, it's mailed into the district, and it says, the question is, should a candidate deliberately lie to homeowner families to achieve his goals? Candidate, and I'll leave the name out, candidate A actually said that he will lie to the public in one of his online blogs, which is now hidden. Compare candidate B, former representative's extensive public record and achievements. The other side has more elaborating on the same thing. I submit that that communication is subject to no reasonable interpretation other than as an attempt to influence the election in that particular district. Some may argue that the expanded definition of express advocacy is too vague and difficult to understand, and I submit that that's a specious argument. It's simply not true. Read the language of the bill. Any doubt goes to the communicator. The communication, when looked at, has to be susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation. So if you can articulate some other reason for the communication, it won't be express advocacy. More than 20 states have had this provision in their law for some time, and the federal government has had it in their law for years, and there are, to me, no cases known where the question of whether the communication is not susceptible to any other reasonable interpretation has actually come up. They're actually quite clear. They're really usually on one side or the other. The other type of communication is electioneering communications. You've seen them all. You've probably had them lodged against you because most of them are negative, but some are positive. They take this form. I have one here. Thank you, Representative A, for promoting job creation. You balance the state's budget by keeping spending in check. Mail to the constituents of voters in that candidate's district before the primary general election. Now, I won't go into the details, but this bill has lots of exceptions to protect that kind of speech other than during that short period before the primary and general election, only in election years. And the courts have recognized over and over again, actually, that this type of regulation or this type of disclosure for this type of communication is constitutional. And that was recognized right up through Citizens United, one of the most recent cases to have a lot to say about disclosure. So the argument that it's too vague has been disproved by not only real-life history in the states and the federal government, but the courts themselves have applied and re-expressed this definition of express advocacy in Supreme Court opinions with no concern about it being too vague. Some may argue that the election and communication disclosure is going to be too burdensome. It is another type of communication that would now be subject to disclosure. You don't have to register. You don't have to open a separate bank account. You don't have to file regular reports with the board. If you already are, you can do it through your political committee or fund. But if you're a 501c4 that wants to do this kind of communication, all you have to do is submit a statement after you've done the communication telling us what you, what it was, not the communication itself, but who you paid, how much you paid, and some limited information about the sources of money that you used to pay for that communication. This is called event-driven reporting. And while some will argue that it's too burdensome, actually, Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life versus Swanson, a recent Minnesota case that made it to the Eighth Circuit, argued that very point, claiming that Minnesota's political fund regulations were too burdensome. And the alternative posed in that case by the lawyers for the plaintiff was event-driven reporting, which is exactly what we've written into this bill. Event-driven reporting is what's used in the federal law and has been upheld by the courts on numerous occasions. So take additionally consider that speakers engaging in this kind of communication, assuming they're not already registered with the board, in which case they just report with their regular reports, they're typically going to be corporations, business corporations, nonprofits, associations that have corporations. These groups maintain member records. They keep track of tens, thousands of members. They file with the IRS. They'll either file a corporate nonprofit return. Some of them have associated for-profit corporations. Some have 501c4s. So they're filing returns. Some of them have registered committees as well. They can do this outside of their committee if they want to. These are groups that are used to reporting, and I submit to you that any argument that the limited reporting that's required and which has been upheld by the courts is unduly burdensome with regard to this particular type of speech. When this bill was heard in both bodies last year, there was an argument that it's going to prohibit a lot of informal type speech that these groups may engage in. There were claims that we engage in a lot of communication at state fairs and county fairs and church groups and civic meetings and so on. This bill doesn't cover that kind of communication. If you do a print type communication, you have to distribute it to voters in the district. And the board has concluded, and in the other body, the bill will specifically state that that means you have to either mail it directly to the voter or you have to drop it off at the voter's door. It's a direct lit drop or mailing. There's no reason or requirement, even in the version that Representative Winkler has offered, to suppose or suggest that this is going to govern or in any way control handing out literature at any kind of public event. Finally, some may argue still, although I think that argument was generally dropped finally last year, that something about this bill might be unconstitutional. I think by the end of the session, when this finally got into the bodies, that argument was dropped, but I'll reiterate in case somebody decides to bring it up again, that since Buckley versus Vallejo and then subsequent cases, including Justice Roberts' case in Wisconsin Right to Life, that's where this language about express advocacy comes from, right out of the case. Justice Roberts created the definition, held that it was constitutional to regulate and require disclosure for this kind of communication. And that same concept has been upheld repeatedly in subsequent court cases and never questioned. So I think there's no question about whether this is unconstitutional or not. The real question is one of political will and whether the legislature thinks at this time that it's time to close these two loopholes. You've seen it in previous elections. I can guarantee you'll see it more and more as we move forward, and that'll probably be the case whether there's disclosure or not. But disclosure provides the citizens and the voters and the opponents with information about who's trying to influence the vote in Minnesota elections. And that's important information to help voters make that decision. And so the board strongly supports this bill and hope that you will give it a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. And I think if it's all right with members, we'll ask the next testifier to come down, and hopefully Mr. Goldsmith can stick around if there are questions for him. Next on the list would be Andrea Rao. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I'm the Legislative Director for MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. MCCL is a grassroots organization with more than 70,000 donors and more than 200 chapters across the state. As we did last session, MCCL opposes the proposed regulations on so-called electioneering communications in this bill because of the chilling effect that they would have on MCCL's ability to engage in grassroots issue advocacy. Issue advocacy groups are private organizations that provide a vehicle for average citizens to effectively participate in the political process by pooling their limited resources to enhance their individual voices. Additionally, issue advocacy groups exist to inform their membership on current events and legislative happenings related to the issues they represent. The disclosure requirements under this legislation may not be burdensome to wealthy individuals or associations that are able to easily hire an attorney and an accountant to file its reports. But for a small organization like MCCL and many other much smaller organizations than us, who do not have a large staff and who do not have millions of dollars in donations handed to them, this will be burdensome immensely. In short, this legislation would have a significant chilling effect on our issue advocacy work. Though MCCL disagrees with the concept of this legislation, for those that do advocate for more disclosure, this legislation is lacking as well. There are many loopholes that exist in the legislation, allowing many communications and organizations in Minnesota to continue acting as they currently do and avoid much of the meaningful disclosure that is claimed to be brought forward in this bill. In the end, we believe that the legislation will provide little meaningful disclosure of the largest voices, while the voices of smaller organizations and interests will be chilled. Regardless of intent, it seems that the real effect of these burdensome reporting requirements is less to inform the public and more to deter citizens from engaging in the issues of the day. MCCL urges the committee to reject this legislation. And that kind of ends my formal testimony, but I would like to comment on a few of the issues that have already been brought forward to the committee today and some of the comments that were made. One was that it was said that there is no reason to run ads mentioning the names of candidates other than unless your intent is to influence an election. And I'd like to give a couple of possible examples of where an actual issue advocacy organization may wish to talk about current events and things that are happening that really have no bearing on an election. Some of those would be that highlighting a law that would be going into effect on August 1st. Many of our laws in Minnesota go into effect at that point in time. It would be very common for organizations to highlight a new law and during that time to mention the name of the author of that legislation or a governor that signed it into law. I think a lot of organizations would run afoul of this and not even have any idea that they're supposed to report because they just are commenting on a new law going into effect. Another issue that could come up would be either a court ruling or a court challenge to some kind of existing law or legislation that was recently passed. That is certainly a current news kind of event that many organizations would comment on if it were to happen, whether it was 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election or in January or December of some year. Also, there is no exclusion for if there happened to be a special legislative session. If you wanted to comment on the events going on in a special legislative session or issues that your organization was interested in, you would only be able to do so if you filed these burdensome reports. And finally, there are oftentimes emerging issues that come up. And this legislation does not allow for discussion of those issues, comments by elected officials who have expertise in those kinds of issues. And all of those things would be examples of reasons why an issue advocacy organization would mention the name of a candidate that really has nothing to do and no bearing on any election. Also, it was suggested that this legislation closes a couple of loopholes that are out there. I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I think it also adds a number of loopholes to this new law. There are a number of things that would not be included, and for folks who are really looking at full disclosure, I don't know how the legislature can bring forward a new piece of legislation offering a new comprehensive kind of disclosure if you're not including emails, if you're not including new kinds of media, online ads, Twitter, Facebook, these kinds of things. This is where elections happen, and a lot of things happen in promoting candidates. And for the legislature to not even consider or discuss any of those kinds of reporting related to those issues, I think just creates a giant loophole. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Ms. Rao from members? Thank you. The next testifier on the list is Sherry Knuth from the Minnesota League of Women Voters. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Knuth, and I am the Policy and Outreach Manager for League of Women Voters, Minnesota. Despite Minnesota's strong culture of civic engagement, the systems that fuel Minnesota's democratic processes are in need of attention. The influence of money in politics represents a threat to the health of our democracy in Minnesota and nationally. The League of Women Voters' position on campaign finance was reached through a two-year study and consensus process at the national level of our organization. Our position is that methods of financing political campaigns should ensure the public's right to know, combat corruption and undue influence, enable candidates to compete more equitably for public office, and allow maximum citizen participation in the political process. By limiting disclosure of independent expenditures to communications using only the magic words of advocacy, Minnesota law does not ensure the public's right to know or allow candidates to compete equitably. As many of you know, advertisers can easily communicate their messages without using the magic words. In fact, the Brennan Center for Justice has said, in layman's terms, an electioneering communication is typically an ad that trashes the candidate on election eve. Evaluating disclosure laws for independent spending in the 50 states, the National Institute on Money in State Politics gives Minnesota an F because our state does not require disclosure of electioneering communications. Determining how much money is spent for elections in Minnesota remains elusive, the Institute states, when the state does not require full disclosure of both forms of independent spending, express advocacy, and electioneering communications. These failures in Minnesota's disclosure system have been exacerbated by the Citizens United decision in 2010, which has triggered an influx of millions of dollars into Minnesota elections by independent spenders. Data from the Campaign Finance Board indicates that in 2012, express advocacy by independent spenders exceeded spending by the candidates themselves in statewide races and legislative races by more than $4 million. This figure does not even account for the additional money spent on electioneering communications because Minnesota does not regulate that spending. In response to some comments made earlier, I'd like to state that we are a small organization, League of Women Voters Minnesota, with a staff of 3 1/3 persons. We have a budget under $400,000. We were required to report our spending in the 2012 campaign against the photo ID. Any burden that we experienced as a small nonprofit organization is offset by the public's need to know about these kind of expenditures. This is disclosure, I would emphasize. It is not a chilling effect on free speech. The Federal Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act and 25 other states require disclosure of electioneering communications. The League of Women Voters urges you to join these states by supporting this bill. By requiring disclosure of communications that are the functional equivalent of express advocacy and disclosure of electioneering communications, Minnesota will keep pace with the manner in which election campaigns are conducted in the 21st century and give the voters, the people who elect you, the information they need to cast an informed vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Knuth. Any questions from members of Ms. Knuth? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The final person who signed up in advance to testify is Mr. John Knapp. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Knapp.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, and members of the committee. My name is John Knapp. I'm with the Winthrop & Weinstein Law Firm in Minneapolis, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership and the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses. The Coalition of Minnesota Businesses is an association of a number of Minnesota business associations, including the Auto Dealers Association, the Realtors, the Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Business Partnership, the Retailers Association, and a few others. The Minnesota Business Partnership and the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses are opposed to House File 1944 because it would dramatically alter existing election law in Minnesota in two very important ways. First, in Section 1, it would expand the current unambiguous definition of express advocacy with a subjective interpretation by a reasonable person standard to determine if a communication is advocating the election or defeat of a candidate. And second, Section 4, would create a new category of regulated political speech based on proximity to an election. The existing state standard of express advocacy uses the magic words test, which has been in place since Buckley versus Valeo, a 1976 U.S. Supreme Court case. And those magic words are words like vote for, elect, defeat, words that clearly convey an election message. Last year, the Minnesota Business Partnership supported codifying this standard, which provides clear guidance to politically active groups. We are concerned that the proposed reasonable person test, which is broader, subjective, and context-based, will cause some organizations not to speak due to fear of breaking an ambiguous law. We also believe that this bill can be chilling on speech by creating a separate category of speech based on proximity to an election. This is similar to the federal standard, but that standard is controversial and has been challenged in court. We are concerned that creating this new category of regulated speech will discourage participation in the political process and unfairly burden organizations who would otherwise choose to communicate their views. The business partnership opposes 1944 and encourages you to vote against this bill. The MVP supports an equal playing field for everyone in election politics, meaningful disclaimers and disclosure of election communications, contributions, and expenditures allow the public to know who is communicating and who is paying. In 2010, the Minnesota Business Partnership worked with Representative Winkler, Senator Rest, and Governor Plenty to support the passage of a bipartisan independent expenditure law, one of the first in the nation following the Citizens United decision. Unfortunately, House File 1944 takes away what is currently free speech, part of the normal everyday process of lawmaking, and creates a new form of government-regulated speech. And Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to suggest, too, that there are two issues that should be in this bill that aren't in this bill, and I'd like you to consider what's not in the bill in making your determination of how to vote on this. Corporations in Minnesota are subject not only to Minnesota Statutes Chapter 10A, which all candidates and political parties are subject to, but there's also regulation of corporate political speech in Minnesota Statutes 211B.15. And what Minnesota Statutes 211B.15 says is that it is a felony for an employee of a business corporation to make an expenditure to promote the election or defeat of a candidate. It's a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. And the corporation who employs that person is subject to having their charter to do business in the state of Minnesota revoked, equivalent, in my opinion, to the corporate death penalty. That's a standard that's only applicable to business corporations. You're creating two new kinds of regulated political speech in this bill, express advocacy and electioneering communications. So let me just give you a practical example. If on August 1st of this year, Ms. Knuth, for example, was to put an ad in Representative Winkler's local paper congratulating him for passing comprehensive campaign finance legislation, there would effectively be no penalty because you've just removed the penalty provisions in the bill. On the other hand, if the League of Women Voters, which I presume is an incorporated entity, was to make that exact same expenditure, the employees of the League would be subject to criminal penalties, and the League could have its charter to do business revoked. Another example, my law firm happens to be incorporated. If I were to run that same ad congratulating Representative Winkler, I would be subject to felony prosecution, and my law firm could lose its right to do business in Minnesota. If a law firm that is a partnership and not a corporation were to run that same ad, there would be no penalty at all. So there's a concept in constitutional law called equal protection, and this is about as devoid of equal protection as just about anything that I can think of. The second thing that should be in this bill is authority for corporations in Minnesota to create political action committees. Shortly after World War II, Federal law was amended to permit both labor unions and business associations to create what are called separate segregated funds. And what the labor unions and the business corporations can do is solicit from their employees or members contributions which go into these separate segregated funds, and the funds, sometimes known as PACs or political action committees, can then donate those funds to candidates. So if we're concerned about independent expenditures in Minnesota, we should be encouraging corporations to form these political action committees that will give to candidates, rather than compelling them to only use the independent expenditure authority that the Citizens United decision gave them. Frankly, I think it's just a healthier way to participate in the political process by making contributions to candidates individually rather than making these independent expenditures. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to appear, and if there are questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp. Any questions for Mr. Knapp, members? Okay, Appreciate it. Before we go to amendments, I just want to entertain other testimony at this point. I'll come around again after we're done with the amendments. But at this point, are there any other people in the audience who wish to be heard? Mr. Schrader, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, my name is Jeremy Schrader. I am the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota, and I am here supporting House File 1944, one of the most important bills before you this session. House File 1944 will allow Minnesotans to know who is trying to influence our democracy and is a first step toward curbing the large amounts of special interest money taking over our elections. I want to first start with a quote by my friend Justice Anthony Scalia, who says that Thomas Jefferson would have said that the more speech the better, so long as people know exactly where the speech is coming from. While my friend and I disagree on many, many issues, this is one that we can agree, that citizens need to know who is funding their elections and their campaigns. And in this aspect, Minnesota is behind the times. As many of you know, Citizens United has allowed unlimited spending on independent expenditures, and we have felt that change here in Minnesota. Elections on every level have gotten more expensive, and last year this body raised the candidate limit for the express reason of competing with this outside money. 25 other states already have reformed those laws to adopt to this Supreme Court case, as well as some others that are coming down the line. And House File 1944 would update Minnesota's law, as well as allow citizens to at least know who is spending this large amount of money. These reasons alone are important, but the situation is much more dire. Right now, Congress inspires the lowest level of confidence in any institution since the Gallup started polling on this question back in 1973. 60% of Americans say members of Congress are more likely to vote in the way that pleases their financial supporters, while only 20% think the representatives would vote in the best interests of their constituents. And this perception is unfortunately based on very specific facts. 84% of members elected to the House of Representatives in 2012, and more than half of the members of Senate, received more money from the 1% of the 1% than all of their other small donors combined. It is a problem when people do not have a faith in their democracy. The legitimacy of our democracy depends on the consent of those governed. What happens when hidden money comes between the government and the voters? House File 1944 is something we can do right now to stop this flood of special interest money. I thank you very much for your time and hope you'll vote yes on House File 1944. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schrader. Any questions for Mr. Schrader? Okay, thank you, Mr. Schrader. Is there anyone else at this point before we take up amendments? Anyone else at this point in the audience who wishes to be heard on the bill? Okay. I notice that there are some other amendments here. Representative Winkler, I take it that these are not your amendments, but is there anyone here who wishes to offer the A2 amendment? Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, before we take the amendments, I was wondering if maybe the committee could have a little bit of discussion have a chance back this up a little bit. In your absence, Representative Halverson, who was chairing at that time, had asked members to dispense with questions until all testifiers were done, and then you kind of came back and you had people going, so there might have been some confusion as to when members could ask questions, and I just defer to you to see if now is a good time for members to ask questions before you went to the amendments.
Sure. No, why don't we do that then? Representative Driscoll, go ahead.
You're the chair. You can go ahead and ask folks have questions. I was just...
Well, no,
from a parliamentary...
No, I assume you have questions. So, go ahead.
Well, then I will go ahead and kind of get the ball rolling on this. Representative Winkler, one of our testifiers had talked about special elections and some of those kinds of things, and maybe not having the same application. Could you just address that issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think you're speaking of Ms. Rao's testimony related to a special session, that there may be issues that arise within an election time frame that organizations may want to address through advocacy. And so I think that's what she was saying.
Okay.
I don't want to speak for her, but she's given me a nod, yes. And here, the important thing is to actually look at what the bill says. If you go to page 4 and look at lines, well, the new language basically, but specifically 1, 2, and then the subparts below that, 3 and 4, in order to qualify as electioneering communication, you have to refer to an identified candidate. So that has to be somebody who's on the ballot in that upcoming election. It has to be 30 days before the primary for the office sought by that candidate, or 60 days before the general election for the office sought by that candidate, and it has to be targeted to the electorate that candidate is in, which that candidate is seeking office. So in other words, if we had a special session of the legislature and there was a major abortion issue before the legislature, it would only be electioneering communications if we also had ads or mail, direct mail, I think, in the as Mr. Goldsmith has described it, direct mail going into a district, identifying that candidate on that issue within that time frame, and specifically targeting that electorate. And I think under that circumstance, you could potentially run into some conflict between issue advocacy and the public's right to know who's influencing the election. But I would put the weight on the side of the public's right to know in the upcoming election. And we're not talking about prohibiting that speech. We're talking about simply disclosing the source of the funds paying for that ad. So we're not saying you can't do it. You know, and I think there's this kind of, you know, this sort of slide into suggesting that they're not able to do it. They are able to do it. They just have to say who pays for it when it could influence the election.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, with the civil penalties being deleted, how would the board enforce this other than a slap on the hand at this point if there aren't civil penalties?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, actually the statutory requirements in Chapter 10A are really the most powerful source of incentive to comply. Most people, we have learned over the years, want to comply with statutory requirements and do so. Late filing fees actually are becoming more and more rare. We had a history in the lobbyist program of lobbyists filing late because there was a 10-day grace period under that program before any late filing fees started, and we had high percentages of people filing within that 10-day grace period. The legislature removed that 10-day grace period, and of all of the 1,400 or so lobbyists that file, only about 3 of them didn't file on time because of the statutory requirement, not because of the $25 per day late filing fee. Besides the statutory requirement, a non-filer or a non-compliant person or committee is also subject to a board action to investigate and weigh in on the matter, and that would often take the form of public findings that there's been a violation. So that's a second powerful tool. And finally, once in a while we do have a person who civil penalties don't matter, late filing fees don't matter. We eventually have to go to court. I'm going to be referring two of those or taking two of those to the board to see if they want to go to court to compel filing. So we do have in Chapter 10A a blanket authorization to seek judicial help if we need to. I might point out that in the gift prohibition program that is a powerful program under Chapter 10A, there are no civil penalties at all.
Representative O'Driscoll?
I'll defer to others at this time, Mr. Chair.
Any other member comments or questions at this point? Remember, we still have to take up amendments. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe this is in here, but I haven't found it yet. What? And maybe you've said it. I don't know. Can you define proximity to the election for me, please?
Representative Winkler.
Chair, Representative Erdahl, if you look on page 4, 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general.
That was on page 3, sorry.
Any follow-up, Representative Erdahl?
Yeah, that's all I want.
I just want to make sure it's in here. Thank you.
All right. Any other member comments or questions at this point? Okay, if not, let's go to the amendments. There's an A2 amendment that's been distributed. I don't know if any member wishes to offer that amendment. There are three others, so. Okay, let's just, Representative Driscoll, do you wish to offer the A2?
Well, Mr. Chair, the genesis behind these, any one of these amendments would probably suffice. I just didn't know the amount. Mr. Goldsmith continually has burdens that are placed on his office and his board by the legislature, and oftentimes money doesn't follow, and he's explained that to us on several occasions. We've been contemplating different law changes and different activities. We know that they were before us before, where they've had some technical issues, and some of that is funding and getting some of those kinds of things resolved and being able to track and cross-track contributions. And I'm sure that there's going to be some confusion and some implementation costs that need to be incurred by the board at this point, and they do have a limited staff. And so I would like to offer an amendment that would allow Mr. Goldsmith appropriate funding to be able to implement this new regulatory requirement that the legislature is putting out. And so my preference would be to leave it as a blank appropriation until we can get a fiscal note to see what the costs are going to be on implementing this. But I would be so inclined to offer one of the others if Mr. Goldsmith thought that those were going to be costs that he would be able to identify for this. I can't believe that there would be any costs to the board to implement this, because he's suggested to us in the past that there's cost burdens for taking on these different kinds of requirements. And so I guess we could leave it open-ended, or we could go with the A4 and or the A2 rather, and go from there.
Representative Winkler, you care to comment at this point?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if an amendment is actually before us or not, but I would just say in general, last session, the Campaign Finance Board received a $331,000 increase in its appropriation as part of the overhaul of some of the campaign finance laws and additional funding. And the work that was included in that $331,000 appropriation was not passed, and that is this bill. So essentially last year, we gave them the increase to do the work, but we didn't actually tell them to do the work. So we would expect a zero fiscal note on this bill. I don't think one has been requested, but there would be a zero fiscal note on this bill because we already gave them the additional appropriation last session, and this session we're following through and requiring them to do the work. So I don't think there's any issue with resources with respect to this bill.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the A2 amendment and request that we do look at the fiscal impact on this, and just to get it before us formally.
Okay. Representative Driscoll moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion to the A2 amendment, members?
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, I do oppose the A2.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would like to hear from Mr. Goldsmith as to the workload that he's had and the appropriation, and if he does have money specifically earmarked for anticipatory legislation like this.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, thank you. What Representative Winkler said is correct. Last year, we requested a substantial increase in funding from $689,000 per fiscal year to $1 million per fiscal year. We're very grateful that both bodies of the legislature passed that. The governor included it in his budget, and we do have that budget, in fact, going forward. At that time, I told the legislature that it would be a minimum of 4 years before I would come back to the legislature for any additional funding, even if routine things were added to our workload, which this is certainly a routine type thing because it's the thing types of things we always do. That funding also gives us in excess of $100,000 per year for infrastructure improvements, which are to rebuild our website, convert to electronic records, and some other major projects like that. We have, in fact, hired one additional management analyst, legal analyst position position, which was in that budget item, and that has taken a great deal of work off of the executive director and the assistant director to provide us with more time to actually manage the agency. I did look at this bill in particular, and with respect to this bill in particular, I would say that the costs involved, while technically one can never say that zero effort is involved for anything, they are so negligible as to be very difficult, if not impossible, to quantify. For example, on the electioneering communications with respect to reporting in the campaign finance software, software already provides a reporting system for independent expenditures, and these new types have the same criteria as independent expenditures. And I asked my IT staff what it would take to change the menu system, how much time it would take to change the menu system to say this is both independent expenditures and express advocacy and electioneering communications. And he said no time at all, but then conceded it would take a few seconds or something. There would be some tweaks to handbooks. We have forms already that would need some minor modification. But to ask to put a dollar amount on this, it's in, you know, dollars rather than thousands of dollars. The question of whether additional advisory opinions or complaints might arise is one that's purely speculative. When we added provisions from Chapter 211B to our law last year, we thought we might have two or three advisory opinions and two or three complaints, and we've had zero. So to say in a fiscal note that we would expect two advisory opinions and two complaints would be just as speculative to say that we would have zero. Certainly Representative Winkler is correct that a fiscal note would suggest we do not want any more money and need any more money. In fact, I would be actually opposed to having additional money, because right now with the funding we have to carefully spend that for infrastructure and other types of improvements. That takes a design and development process, and keeping more money on top of that doesn't really help us.
Members, you heard it here first. Someone from an agency saying he doesn't want more money. That's an unsession.
He opposes it.
Right.
And he doesn't even work for the governor.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, I was going to underscore that as well, and that apparently this isn't going to be for just one fiscal period. It's going to be for the next 4 years, which we have 1 year off of that. So I find that a very bold move on your part, Mr. Goldsmith, that you're going to do what you need to do and fix some of those things that have been concerns of the Elections Committee and the public on those without any additional money over the next, well, be 3 years at this point. So I laud you for that and hope you're successful in your endeavor.
Mr. Chair, just one other comment. I will make a caveat. That was without significant change. So if you, for example, decided to put electioneering communication, or not, to put local elections under Chapter 10A and make us handle local election disclosure, that would be different. Or if you decided to put all of Chapter 211B under our jurisdiction, that would be different. Sure. But these are routine things. And yes, I told the legislature last year that I wouldn't be back for 4 years, and that's a commitment you have for me.
Mr. Chair, I knew it was too good to be true.
Representative
O'Driscoll, I actually have a bill to do that. So.
Representative Winkler, I'm not surprised.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair.
To the amendment.
Mr. Goldsmith, can you tell me what, if somebody violates this, what the penalty actually is? Because when we took out subdivision 8 on page 8, lines 21 through 36, we took the penalty out. If they don't file their statements, can you tell me what the penalty is now? Because without it stating what it is, I don't believe there is any penalties for them not to file their statements.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. First of all, let me go back one step and point out that this new provision is for entities that are not registered with the board and do not choose to register with the board. So if groups are going to do this through a political committee or fund, their reporting structure is different and all the civil penalties are in place for those groups. For a group that doesn't register with the board but wants to do this, the first issue is we won't know about it. So it will have to come to us somehow in the form of a complaint or a letter or someone sending us a piece of material. At that point, if it's a complaint, we would need to determine whether to investigate or not. If it's a letter, we would probably send out an inquiry, and we would inform this organization of their obligation. In most cases, we find that then that organizations, once knowing what the legal obligation is, because it is a statutory requirement, will comply because they don't want to violate the statutes. But if they didn't, the next steps would be for the board to launch a formal investigation, which would result potentially in findings, public findings, that this organization engaged in this communication that was covered by statute and refused to comply with the disclosure provisions, and that would be public. If the board wanted to take it to the final step, the board could go to court to seek an order to compel that disclosure.
Representative Johnson.
So there is still a civil action that you could process through, or is it, because this is out, would it end up being, by other areas of the statute, be classified as a misdemeanor if they did not provide that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there's a Chapter 10A specifically provides that unless otherwise stated in statute, violations of Chapter 10A are not crimes, so it would not be a misdemeanor. This does not specify it's a misdemeanor. It would be a civil action for an order to compel the disclosure. And there is a provision, I believe it's 10A.34, that gives the board general authority to seek civil remedies to compel conduct.
Any other testimony? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, so in other words, you're putting this law in and it doesn't have any teeth because you're not authorized to issue any fines or civil penalties because that section was taken out?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I would not say it doesn't have any teeth. First of all, the mere fact that failure to comply would be a statutory violation is a significant consideration for most organizations that are engaged in communication in the political marketplace. A public finding of a violation, likewise, is a significant consideration. And a judicial order to comply is the ultimate teeth, if you want to use that word. As I have mentioned before, late filing fees and civil penalties are actually fairly ineffective. Late filing fees and civil penalties are primarily to keep people who want to file on time, and people who want to cooperate to keep them cooperating. A group that doesn't know its obligation isn't going to have a late filing fee anyway, because until we tell them what they have to do, the filing fee wouldn't accrue. So I don't look at late filing fees and civil penalties for failure to file as significant incentives to actually compel that filing in most cases.
Representative Johnson.
No, Mr. Chair, I just don't think that any organization would comply with you, because yet you would actually have no authority to fine them anything, and your own statute 10A.34 subdivision 3 depicts anything in this statute is not a crime. So unless you have some civil penalties specifically with this, I don't believe you have the authority to even levy any civil penalties.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we did hear from Mr. Knapp on behalf of the business partnership, who talked about the danger to corporate officers in the criminal code. I would tend to think that if you had concerns about this legislation, you might prefer that the civil penalties would not exist. If you would insist that civil penalties be in there, we could have that conversation. But right now, the voluntary compliance, public embarrassment, and a civil court order, which, by the way, if you are in contempt of court, there are real penalties involved. So if you have to get to that stage before you're willing to do it, there would be real penalties involved, and you just don't. I think it's very inaccurate to say that there is no enforcement here. It's not, this. We could, I suppose, make this all criminal too, but I don't think that's the idea. The idea is to encourage voluntary compliance.
Any other discussion to the amendment? We're on the amendment, on the A2 amendment. Okay. See, anyone who wishes to be heard from the audience on the A2 amendment? Okay, seeing no further testimony, all in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. No. Motion does not prevail. We're now on to the bill. Unless anyone wants to offer the A3 and A4 amendment, they seem to be substantially similar. We're on to the bill as a whole. Any further testimony or comments from members on the bill on 1944? Anyone else in the audience who wishes to be... Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Sanders.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there's no other
comments from members. I'll make a couple. Representative Winkler, thank you. I believe your intent in all of this is good. I think that you've been working on these issues for quite some time. You've been consistent on them. Your bill was earlier this week, reinstating the gift ban. You had all the Republicans in the House voting with you. I wish you would have had all of your Democrat colleagues voting with you as well on the bill. But I do think this body's had a strong record of looking for disclosure. 2010, we had a strong bipartisan bill that was signed by the governor. In the last session, this bill, a lot of these provisions didn't make it through the process. And some would say that the version that this bill is in, although very similar, some would say it's worse, nothing else. It's similar, and this bill is back before us. I don't believe that this bill is written in a way that really is written on the basis of equal disclosure, full disclosure across the spectrum. Mr. Knapp, I think, eloquently pointed out where we have some loopholes, where we have some problems, where there is not equal application of these rules and these laws when it comes to disclosure, and that's important to me. I think that across the board, I think we need to take a comprehensive look, and I'm for full disclosure. Let's get it out there, but it should apply to everybody equally, and we should have equal penalties as well across the board. So I remain open to working with you. I hope that we can arrive at something that we can have strong bipartisan agreement with. I don't think this bill is to that spot yet, so I'll oppose the bill today, but again, remain open to working with you to see if we can arrive at something that could move through the process and get strong bipartisan support, as the governor has stated he's looking for on election bills. So you'll have my willingness and openness to work with you, but I'll oppose the bill today and ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Any other comments on the bill? Anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on the bill before we vote on the bill? Representative Winkler, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Sanders, I'm actually a little bit mystified by the opposition to this bill. To me, this seems like a very straightforward extension of the disclosure work that we have done since 2010. The electioneering communications, the express advocacy provisions are very clearly designed to close pretty obvious loopholes for avoiding the disclosure laws that we have. I do take seriously the concerns from Mr. Knapp related to criminal penalties. That is something that we did work on in 2010 as well. It is something that I know that they're concerned about, and we, I think, have shown a good faith effort to try to deal fairly on that point. I do not agree that somehow small organizations or large organizations are treated differently by this law. If you are spending money in campaign season and telling voters about a particular candidate's position on an issue, it is very hard to convince any reasonable person that that's not for the purpose of changing of shaping the election. And that's the world we live in. We wouldn't be working on disclosure laws if we could have the corporate prohibition and the union prohibition on direct on independent expenditures for campaigns. If we had that the way we used to, and you can talk about judicial elections, you can talk about all sorts of things, but the U.S. Supreme Court has put us in this position of having more money flowing in different ways, and when we try to respond with more disclosure, I think we should go across the board. So that's the world we live in, but I don't think the citizens of Minnesota expect us to fund elections in secret, and that is certainly not part of our tradition of clean elections in Minnesota. So I think we have to take this step. I'm open to working on reasonable accommodations, but to oppose it on principle, I think, does a disservice to elections in Minnesota, and it's a tradition we should all be proud of. So I would ask for your yes vote with my commitment to find a way to get bipartisan support for a pretty straightforward set of reforms.
With that, members, we'll take the vote. Mr. Verdon, roll call has been requested.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Halverson?
Aye.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Dowd? Representative Huntley?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Representative Lane.
Aye.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Erdahl.
No.
Representative Winkler.
Aye. By a vote of 7-4, the motion prevails, and the bill is passed. And right, and the motion is that the bill be re-referred to the General Register. So, members, that is it for now. Our next meeting is next Tuesday, March 18th at 12:30. There's no other business before the committee. The committee is adjourned.